chapter 51. And so the Vulcarans rose up once more in weary unison, mocked by the dark expanse of ocean that for their haggard nation represented the divide between wealth and squalor, of pride and disgrace. In the breaking light of a harsh new reality, their vengeful spirits were tantalized by the prospect of retribution and rampage. Reinvigorated by a vindictive purpose, with the wound to their pride still stinging deeply, the Vulcarans had planned heavily in order to cast off the uncertainty of chance. Galvanized by hate, loss, and experience, they were meticulous in their preparations. Across several months, their desperation and humiliation drove them, every man, woman, and child of workable age, to forgo rest and to submit themselves entirely to their common cause of revenge. Under uncompromising surveillance, the weary people of Vulcarin felled trees in the hundreds and forged tools and weapons from the remaining resources of the earth that they had not already laid waste to in the past. A fleet of sturdy boats were assembled, and the surrounding ocean, replenished of its fish stocks throughout 5 years of reprieve, was once more plundered voraciously to fuel the frenzied effort. Together, they labored like wild-eyed Trojans, uncharacteristically united in their imperious goal of reclaiming the ill-gotten bounty to which they had grown accustomed over a half-decade. For those few who complained or shirked their share of the toil, punishment was severe and public, justified under the premise of the common good. At the heart of it all was Morgarat. His vitriol in the aftermath of the expulsion from Hohalla had been fearsome and uncompromising, his zeal for revenge and reclamation so terrible that his disillusioned and devastated people felt they had little option than to submit to his unbending decrees. It was heralded by Morgarat as the true second coming of their nation, a moment of renewal and retaliation. And to his exhausted subjects, he quoted often the lines of verse discovered among the yellowing parchments of his great-great-grandfather that in his own youth had nourished the seed of unyielding ambition within him. Undaunted by the foes we face, the superiority of our race ensures our noble history is marked by fearless victory. Oppose us and await a flood, an ocean deep of tears and blood. All hail upon the rising dawn, the fatherland of Vulcarin. Daily, the fatigued hordes were coerced into delirious, unified renditions of the chant, which Morgarat was convinced would drive the work effort forward. As hard and uncompromising as a northern tundra, he pushed, threatened, and harried the people to work to the limits of their crippled spirits and famished bodies. There were almost daily deaths from exhaustion or accidents, while the ill-advised few who raised their voices in weary objection, more often than not, were not seen again the following day. The one man who wished he could be counted among the ill-fated number, released by death, was Suma. His body decimated by torture and his soul ravaged by regret, he'd adhered under duress to the maniacal demands of the Vulcarin leader by sharing his expertise in design and construction, a circumstance that had sharpened his bitter resentment. His sense of guilt following the deaths of four innocent young men and the savage mutilation of another as a result of his initial refusal to yield to Morgarat's will had weakened his resolve and, despite his revulsion toward the leader's ultimate goal, he'd relented and undertaken the multitude of tasks that he'd been assigned. Outside of drawing up plans and directions for the building of boats, battle axes, and daggers, Suma had been charged with the design of a unique and complex weapon that, as demanded by Morgarat, would ensure their people of their triumph. The beast, as Morgarat termed the infuriating creature, was deemed by the Vulcarin leader to be the sole obstacle in the path to glory. Over the course of several months, haunted by a remorse that cleaved at his conscience like a blade, Suma invented a complex apparatus that he believed had the capability to eliminate the beast's aerial threat. The mechanism was elaborate and imposing, its primary function to launch a torrent of boulders at rapid speed and then repeat the same strike in quick succession. The design incorporated two 18-foot-long tapered wooden whips, which were 4 inches in diameter and made from a particular species of tree that was distinctly flexible and durable. The fruit of Suma's unwilling labors was an armory of 12 painstakingly constructed catapults. They were towering contraptions, anchored to the ground by weighty and wide-set wooden bases with great wheels that trundled and grinded oppressively across the earth. On the end of an extensive hinge along which the wooden whips were attached, a net of thick and sturdy rubber webbing that resembled a vast basket crowned each remarkable machine. With a series of pulleys and straps, teams of men could easily bend the strong, flexible whips down to the ground. Upon loading the boulders into the webbing, the whips could be released and projectiles launched with devastating accuracy. And while the power of the machine's strikes was indeed ferocious, it was the rapidity and flexibility with which the devices could be reloaded, angled, and transported that demonstrated the extent of Suma's engineering genius. Upon completion of the newly built jewels in the Volkerin's arsenal, Morgorath's obsessive focus switched to ensuring that his soldiers were proficient in the operation of the catapults. Extensive training was provided for those men most physically capable of maneuvering the immense levers and muscle-wrenching hinges. Long days that stretched to weeks were given over to ensuring that there was no possible ambiguity as to the most effective methods of delivering lethally accurate strikes to counter the agility of the Hohalian's winged protector. Overall, Morgorath's preparations, from the retraining of his fighters in combat and arson to the instructing of his charges in methods of interrogation and torture, were meticulous and marked by a determination to leave nothing to chance. His patience was cool and measured, the necessity for calculated planning winning out over his festering lust for fire and blood. It was not, however, the time frame for training and preparations that dictated Morgorath's ultimate determination as to the date they would make the voyage back to Hohalla. To the Volkerin leader, a mere siege of the village was insufficient. So deeply ran the wound to his hubris that he could not be consoled by the idea of bringing forth the hand of destruction alone. Morgorath yearned for terror and misery, for tragedy in its most searing guise. Through the brutal torment of Suma's body and spirit, he'd eventually extracted the information that made the embers of his black heart flicker malignantly. The marriage of the Hohalian princess to the man that had caused him such grievous humiliation was the type of fateful occasion that his vindictive mind had thirsted for in the dark and solitary nightmare. On one unfortunate evening, a dazed and harrowed Suma, barely lucid from the latest sadistic beating he'd endured, had mumbled under duress the dates of the impending Hohalian wedding celebration through swollen, punctured lips. With his battered body barely clinging to consciousness, he divulged the details of the royal couple's nuptials, and Morgorath had been practically ecstatic at the revelation. On the night before his army's much-anticipated departure, as the riot-hungry Volkerin legion loitered along the coastline, and as a devastated Suma wept in dreadful expectation from his vermin-infested cell, Morgorath sat in the darkness of his sleeping quarters, a dram of harsh moonshine in his fist, and visualized the hypnotic spectacle of a Hohalla in flames. Drunkenly, he sneered to himself as his eyes wandered across the gold-tinged tumbler, the brooding glow of the fireplace glinting along its transparent edges. As his blood stirred with suspense and intoxication, overcome by the surge of violence in his veins, the Volkerin leader drank in deeply the remaining contents of the glass before flinging the container at the crackling hearth. A course of shattering filled the glum silence of the cottage, and as the wayward droplets of the liquor hissed angrily among the coals, the remaining cinders were extinguished, and the firelight was overtaken by darkness.